Our show's name pays tribute to the Boer Trekkers of South Africa, who in 1838 soundly defeated 30,000 Zulus on the bank of the Nkomo River, thereafter called Blood River, from the water turning red with the blood of the slain. Miraculously, no Boer Trekker died and only three were wounded. Now, your friend, Eddie Miller, will be your ambassador for tonight's show.
Dear Blood River Radio family, I certainly appreciate you hanging on, and you hung on. It's going to be well worth your time for hanging on, because we have this fellow we got here. We all know him. You'll know him when he comes on. We've had one of our most staunch followers and contributors and supporters, a big-time lawyer from up in Yankeeville, but he follows the Southern Show like this, and he has dubbed this guy a national treasure. I will second that. He's a national treasure. For one thing, if I don't, he'll cut my head off with one of those swords, because he's out after these damn Yankees all the time. And you know, when he really gets riled up, he don't care who what head falls, man, because he gets into it. I mean, you just don't be in the way, especially if you're a Yankee. Well, that's why we call him the Bitter Ender. So the Bitter Ender is also a national treasure, and here he is in person. We'll let him tell you anything he needs to tell you right now. Let him say hello. If he's in a bad mood, I would get a little further away from the radio than usual.
So. It could blow out. Well, they don't have tubes in the radio anymore. They can't blow that out.
So. Bitter Ender, I tell you, gave you a debut there. It's really not up to what you deserve, but that's the best I can do right now because my throat's kind of sore, brother. So go take us away, brother.
Okay. I don't know about that national treasure. I saw that movie once. I didn't see it again. Anyway, had a couple of things we'd like to throw out to our listening audience this evening, and they really don't sound related, but there is a tie between them. I'd like to talk a little bit about our Sons of Confederate Veterans Camp that I'm a member of, and also the Confederate Constitution. Now, that seems like they're pretty far apart. But the Sons of Confederate Veterans were started in 1896 in New Orleans. And Stephen D. Lee, who was a corps commander in the Army of Tennessee and fought at the Battle of Nashville and several battles in Mississippi, gave the charge to the Sons to protect the Confederate soldiers' good name. And a lot of the veterans were dying off, and they needed to go to the next generation to help take care of the veterans and help raise money for monuments and take care of the cemeteries and so forth. You know, the things that the communists and the Taliban are tearing down today. But I joined the Sons of Confederate Veterans, SCV, in 1988 and joined the Sam Davis Camp. And each local chapter or camp, as they're called, is named after a Confederate soldier or hero or something to do with the Confederacy. Now, Sam Davis was a member of Coleman Scouts, and the Coleman Scouts were like Marine Recon or Navy SEALs or Special Ops. They operated behind Union lines, and they were not spies. They wore their Confederate uniform, and they knew how to hide and infiltrate the federal lines and then send in information to Braxton Bragg and the Confederate Army at Tennessee. Sam was captured down at Pulaski, Tennessee, in November of 1863 by Yankees who were wearing Confederate uniforms. And he was taken, they searched his body, and in the heel of his boot, he had a lot of information about the Yankee reinforcements that were being sent to Chattanooga to lift the siege of Chattanooga. And so they took him before General Grenville Dodge. Never have cared much for the NRA because Dodge was one of the founders of the National Rifle Association. But anyway, he knew that Sam wasn't head of this organization, but he figured he could scare this young boy, who was only 21 years old, into telling him who was head of it. So Sam wouldn't talk. And so he threatened to hang him if he didn't give him the information, and he gave him 3 days to think about it. And Sam still wouldn't talk. So they took him outside of Pulaski, put him up on a gallows, put a rope around his neck, and gave him one more chance. This rider came up and said, well, the general is going to give you one more chance if you'll divulge the name of your commanding officer. And his quote was, if I had 1,000 lives, I would give them all before I would betray my country or the confidence of a friend. And wow, they hung him. And the irony was that Captain Freeman, his commanding officer, was in the jail cell right next to him. And they had talked the night before, and Captain Freeman told him, Sam, go ahead and give them my name. There's no sense you getting killed. He said, no, sir, if I give them your name, they'll hang both of us. So he chose death over betraying a friend. And they put up, in 1909, they put up a monument to Sam Davis on the Capitol grounds. And our spineless governor, Bill Slick Willie Lee, hadn't taken it down yet. So anyway, that's the history of the namesake of our Sons of Confederate Veterans Camp. And when I joined, we actually had two real sons. Their, Mr. George Herbert, Mr. Bob Herbert, their father was Robert Herbert, and he rode in the Coleman Scouts with Sam Davis. Now, two Herberts were in their 90s, and Mr. George was kind of in bad health, didn't say too much, but Mr. Bob was a real character, funny. He said, yeah, my dad was 15 years old, and he rode with the Coleman Scouts. The Yankees stopped him one time out on the road, and they didn't know who he was or what he was doing, and they searched him and didn't find anything on him. And they took his horse and just smacked him around, kicked him off in a ditch. But Mr. Bob said, if they'd have searched the heel of his boot and found out what he was carrying, they'd have hung him just like they hung Sam Davis. And then he laughed and said, then I wouldn't be here. Anyway. To tie it into the Confederate Constitution, they would send the camp adjutant would send out a postcard and say, you know, the next meeting is such and such a date, time. And they'd always announce who the guest speaker was going to be and what the program was. So I'd been in the camp 3 or 4 months, and the card said, you know, date and time and everything. Guest speaker is Devereaux Cannon, the Confederate Constitution. And I thought, oh, golly, Dave, that's going to be dull as dishwater. But anyway, I'm a member. I ought to go, you know, support the camp. One of the best programs I've ever heard in my life. Devereaux had a sharp wit and very sarcastic about the Lincoln imperial government, and did a fantastic job of explaining the differences between the Confederate Constitution and the U.S. Constitution. And the story does have a rather tragic ending, though. Devereaux had a farm up in Sumner County, up north of Nashville, and a horse stumbled and threw him, and he hit the ground and died of a brain aneurysm. And a young guy, I think he was only in his 40s, when that happened to him.
Didn't he do a book on flags, a beautiful book on flags, Devereaux?
Yep. Uh-huh. And I got that card. I didn't know how to pronounce his name. I said, Devereaux Cannon. Who's this guy? I don't want to go. No, he did that book, Flags of the Confederacy. Also did that, yes.
The statue of Sam Davis. Now, I've been at Pulaski. I took a photograph of the Davis Monument. That was the reason I went there, I guess. But is the monument still in Pulaski?
Still in Pulaski, yes. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the usual suspects started whining and crying and trying to get it taken down. And people in Giles County just said, shut up and go get a job. And as far as I know, it's still there. So, and then Slick Willie Lee hadn't gotten rid of the one on the Capitol grounds in Nashville. That was put up, I think it was 1909, and the person that helped raise the money for that was Sumner Cunningham, who was editor of Confederate Veteran Magazine, and he ran a lot of ads in the Confederate Veteran to get people to donate, and people were donating a nickel and 25 cents and things like that, which was a lot of money for Southerners after the war, because, you know, everybody was poor and broke, and our farm lands had been destroyed, our industry had been destroyed. So a nickel or 10 or 15 cents was quite a lot of money. So they raised
like
enough
the forest statue.
It was 1909 also. Two statues, two great statues, same year.
People didn't have any money then.
No, but it was hard to put up statues for at that time. Not that they didn't want to, it just they didn't have the money to do it. So I thought that's what we would talk about tonight, and I wish we could get Devereaux on the program. You would really enjoy his humor and sarcastic wit, and just give an example. He called the blacks our former property, and he says, well, I see in the paper one of our former properties went into a convenience store and shot and killed the clerk and shot two people that were just trying to buy some candy or something, and then carjacked somebody. So I guess they didn't like being free, and they want to go back to the plantation. So the state of Tennessee is going to let them live for the rest of their life on the Tennessee's maximum security plantation up at Brushy Mountain. So he did have a way of making humor out of certain situations. So the Confederate Constitution had a great book, and I was clearing out some of my library and found this and hadn't read it in a long time. It's called The Confederate Constitution of 1861, and we'll come back to it right after the break.
Be back in a second, folks.
Have you ever heard of Loving Liberty Ladies? Well, the Loving Liberty Ladies are here to help you learn our American heritage and the way it affects today's society. The Loving Liberty Ladies also have a discussion guide called Proclaim Liberty. And with this guide, you can start your own group in your hometown. Get yours today on our website at lovingliberty.net. Look for our lesson supplements, too. They're free. To hear all the special offers and to join the fight for freedom and liberty, please go to lovingliberty.net.
Okay, listen up, people. I'm beating the bushes for a few good men. I don't want you boys of the alt-right. I want the hardcore of the hard right. And I need you front and center, boots on the ground, at a minute's notice, in the streets, and I need your money. You know the problem that the whites of the world face. It's the all-too-real threat of global extermination. And you know what's going on in South Africa and Western Europe. And unless you're semi-comatose, you've already seen the first stages of white genocide unfolding in our country. Our culture is under constant full-scale attack by our enemy. The enemy never sleeps. They spend day and night wrecking the monuments and the graves of our beloved kin. They attack us physically everywhere we go. They've already taken the linen and our stone. Now they're coming after our flesh. And if you're not too squeamish, if you want to be part of the number one white advocacy group and the number one white civil defense group in the United States, then contact Eddie Bombardier Miller at BloodRiverRadio.com. And please, please donate. And God knows you need us as much as we need you. Thank you.
The spirit of the American West is alive and well in Range Magazine, the award-winning quarterly devoted to the issues of the American West. Each issue contains informative articles, breathtaking imagery, as well as the culture of cowboy spirit today, and gift ideas, like this year's Buckaroo Calendar. Order online from rangemagazine.com. Loving Liberty Network salutes the spirit of the American West at rangemagazine.com.
Dear Blood River Radio family, without further ado, we're going to go back. I think that Sister Nancy has a comment or two to make. So we'll go right back to her, and then she's going to bounce it back to the bitter ender. Go ahead, Sister Nancy.
Well, I don't know whether maybe Jean would like to continue on the Constitution.
No, we'll pick it up later. Go ahead. You made some good points there on the break. I think people will be interested in hearing that.
Okay, I've been reading several books because it's been so cold here in Louisville. I've been kind of hogtied inside the house, getting cabin fever. And I read one book, reread a book that I picked up at Fort Jefferson where Dr. Mudd was incarcerated. Actually, they gave him life with hard labor. Of course, thank the Lord, he got a reprieve after 4 years. But I tell you the truth, the reason I was very interested in Mudd was because I have had a great deal of interest in his, another prisoner who was at Fort Jefferson. That was George St. Ledger Grenfell. He was a British volunteer for the Confederacy. And he actually died in an escape attempt from Fort Jefferson, which is about 70 miles off the coast of Key West. I went down there. And I wanted to get a marker put up in the fort to Grenfell, but of course they wouldn't allow it. Now there is a marker down there to Dr. Mudd, but I recently just finished today a book. The book is titled Major General James Lawson Kemper, CSA, The Confederacy's Forgotten Son by Harold R. Woodward Jr. Now, Kemper and I go back through the 1714 early Germans, his family and my Hitt family came in as indentured servants into Virginia to work for Governor Spotswood to receive land. And I've actually been to Madison where he had a home. But the interesting thing about Kemper was, yes, he became a lawyer, and he was at the Battle of Gettysburg, in which the division, he went forward as, I guess he was a regimental leader in the division. And
he was a brigade commander. He was one of the three brigade commanders under Pickett's division.
Well, what happened, of course, is he went in on horseback, and they were advised not to do that. Garnett also went on horseback because he was ill that day. And, of course, Pickett's charge was hell on earth. And Garnett and Amistad was on foot. They were both killed. And Kemper received a very, very painful mini-ball wound in the groin that actually went through his body, and it ended up at the base of his spine. So, basically, he was paralyzed. But what happened is he was shifted around. The Confederates, well, he was taken by the Yankees. Then the Confederates got him. In the transition, the buggy fell. He fell out and injured himself even while had this immense, this horrible injury.
Damn.
Ultimately, he was taken by the Yankees, and I guess they gave him some kind of halfway treatment. He was actually in a cell, or you could call it, I guess you could call it their kind of Yankee hospital, with Ewell, who had his leg amputated. And I think Ewell was an unbelievable man too, kind of like John Bell Hood. They both continued to serve after these massive injuries and amputations. And Ewell, I think, went on to ride on horseback, and he had one leg amputated. So I think people, if they would only take the time to read a real history of what these people sustained and went through, maybe they would have more understanding of our heroes. And they were our heroes.
Yes, absolutely.
They are always going to be our heroes. They will, in my mind, somebody said, oh, well, that's kind of old history. No, I don't think the history of our great men will ever die. I hope it doesn't. I don't think it will ever die.
As long as we have you and Gene on Blood River Radio, this history isn't never going to die, and I hope we could preserve it some kind of way in perpetuity. But Brother Gene said that if Stonewall Jackson had not have been killed, that Gettysburg, the Pickett's charge never would have happened. I listen to every word that Bitter Ender says. Yeah. And he also said that
it wasn't me. It was a lot of historians that said that they would have finished off the federal army that was being fed into Gettysburg piecemeal, and they stopped the attack late that afternoon on July the 1st. And Jackson was like a shark. When he smelled blood in the water, he was going after him, and he wouldn't have stopped the attack until they'd driven the federal army back down the road to Washington. That's a what if.
What happened with Kemper is, I'll just make it short. What happened with Kemper is that he did survive. They did not. They actually built a coffin for him. He was.
Damn.
They did not think he was going to make it. They had a coffin already. They had the coffin by his bed. If you can imagine that, they knew. They felt that he would. That the wound was too serious. That there was too much blood lost. How these people survived. How they recovered. Now, this was a horrible injury. He was basically paralyzed on the left side and for quite a while. But at any rate, what I'm getting at, he became a political hero to Virginia. And he did, after all this, you know, they even had some they really felt that there would be some understanding with these damn federal monsters, which just could not work out. There was no way. They were reconstructed. And finally, in 72, between 72 and 78, he became the governor of Virginia. But the last part of his life was full of suffering from this horrible injury. But here's something that I know you know, Gene, but I didn't realize this. He mentioned this. Now, we know that Simon Boulevard Buckner's grandson, Nathan Bedford Forrest's grandson, died in World War II action, but also Kemper's grandson died in World War II action.
Oh, my damn.
Huh. I did not know that.
I didn't either.
Yeah.
Well, I taught you something. Okay. Well, that's kind of what I was interested in. Was just his book it's a great book. It's an easy read. And, of course, it's interesting, super interesting to me, because his ancestry and my ancestry goes back to these early 1714 indentured Germans. And, you know, I've been past his home. I've been in Madison. I know his home is still standing.
That's really great that you could tie the two families together like that. That really is interesting. Yeah, you're right. Bedford Forrest's grandson, Nathan Bedford Forrest III, was the first American general killed in World War II. He is a B-17 pilot, and when his squadron went out on a mission, he went with them, where somebody with that rank would usually stay back in the rear with the gear, but Forrest's family didn't do that. And he would go out with them, got shot down, and the Germans found the wreckage of the plane and found out who it was and gave him military honors and turned him back over to the British and to the Allies. They had that much respect for it.
We wouldn't have done that for the Germans.
The Germans had a respect for him, but the United States Army does not. They had a display of his uniform at Fort Leavenworth. It was one of the military bases in Kansas, Fort Leavenworth, or I've forgotten what the other one is. But one black on the base there read the name Forrest and started whining and complaining, and they cleaned out the whole display. So here was a worthless dirtbag that probably never heard a shot fired in anger, and here he got rid of a display of an Army general that gave his life for the United States military. And that shows you what kind of country we have today.
Yeah. Here's something about Kemper's grandson. He said James Lawson, Kemper, in the Kemper military tradition, graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy in 1932 and was killed in action during the second day of the great American naval victory at Guadalcanal, November the 13th in 1942. He held the rank of commander. But poor old Kemper, he had a rough time.
And that's the truth. Yeah. So, yeah, it's amazing, like you said, what those people could go through and survive and carry on with their life, even had any crippling injuries. Of course, Bedford Forrest was shot four times during the war, and two of the bullets were so close to his spine that the surgeons were afraid to try to get him out. They're afraid he's either going to kill him or paralyze him. So he carried two of those big 58 caliber bullets the rest of his life. And they think that may have contributed to his death. He could have been lead poisoning, or there were several other things that he had that he just pretty much, he was a big man. He was 6'2", weighed over 200 pounds, very muscular. But they said by the time he died, they think it was diabetes. He weighed less than 100 pounds. He pretty much just wasted away to nothing.
That's so sad.
So that was a different generation from what we have today.
Yeah,
those people, how they recovered from these amputations. And I want to mention one other thing, that our war to get freedom from the Yankees we know it's very complicated. Very much like what happened to the Germans with the decimation of the countryside. But here's interesting. Kemper wanted to continue after he was able to recover. He wanted to continue his service.
Sister Nancy, we have to go to a break. We'll continue. We'll come back to you for as soon as we come back to this break. Hang on, folks.
Exposing corruption, informing citizens, pursuing liberty. You're listening to Liberty News Radio.
USA News, I'm Laura Winters. Staggering sums of money former President Donald Trump ordered to pay E. Jean Carroll a whopping total of $83 million in damages for defaming her. The New York jury in federal court awarding $18 million in compensatory damages and $65 million in punitive damages. She originally asked for $10 million. The jury deliberated for 3 hours and came to a unanimous verdict. Now, on Truth Social, Donald Trump writing, "Absolutely ridiculous!" Exclamation point. I fully disagree with both verdicts and will be appealing this whole Biden-directed witch hunt focused on me and the Republican Party. Our legal system is out of control and being used as a political weapon, he writes. They have taken away all First Amendment rights. This is not America! Exclamation point. In other news, a warning to Americans traveling to the Bahamas, as there have been 18 murders there so far this year. The U.S. Embassy in the Bahamas releasing a security warning and travel advisory in light of an uptick in gang violence. Now, earlier in the week, the State Department putting Jamaica on a travel advisory list due to an increase in violence there. And supermarkets packed with snacks, booze, and munchies ahead of a big weekend in sports. The stage now set for the top four teams in the NFL to face off on Sunday. Corey Myers now with a preview.
We find out who's taking part in the Super Bowl this weekend. On Sunday, first, the Kansas City Chiefs take on the Ravens in the AFC Championship. That one's in Baltimore. Kickoff set for 3 p.m. Eastern from M&T Bank Stadium. In the NFC Championship, the Detroit Lions traveling to the West Coast to take on the San Francisco 49ers. Kickoff there, 6:30 Eastern from Levi's Stadium in Santa Clara.
This is USA News.
Omaha Steaks is rewriting the book on burgers with an all-new handmade texture for the juiciest home-style burgers you've ever tasted. Their pure-ground burgers are made from single cuts of real, aged Omaha steaks. These are truly steaks on a bun. Filet mignon, ribeye, New York strip, sirloin, and even brisket burgers. Now is the time to experience the exclusive Burger Perfection Flight for just $79.99. Go to omahasteaks.com and use promo code TREAT at checkout to get an extra $20 off your order plus free shipping. You'll get four of each pure ground burger so you can sample all the steak on a bun greatness. These burgers are crafted for a juicier, more tender experience, making your mouth water with every single bite. Don't wait. Go to omahasteaks.com. Use promo code TREAT at checkout and get $20 off the Burger Perfection Flight and discover your new burger obsession. Minimum order may be required.
Blood River Radio is the only news media in the United States whose sole purpose of being is to fight against the ever-rising tide of global white genocide, both soft and hard genocide, whether it is in the form of ethnic cleansing via the current massive invasion of non-white, non-Christian hordes that are overwhelming the once all-white nations of Western Europe, the United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the United States, or via the hard genocide in South Africa, where the rape, murder, and torture of whites is an ongoing daily occurrence. Though we are a Christian brotherhood, we will cooperate with other groups in our operations if it will shorten our people's casualty list. We further pledge to you to leave the radio studio at every opportunity and take it to our churches, to our universities, and most importantly, we promise to occupy the streets. However, none of our mission can succeed without funding. Please help us all that you can and donate to our cause by going to www.bloodriverradio.com.
This is a battle between truth and deceit, a battle between forces that would enslave this country in darkness and between a media that wants to present you with the truth.
We are being censored. America's news outlets no longer provide the truth. 90% of news outlets in the United States are controlled by 6 corporations. The mission of the Epoch Times is to chase the truth, to ground all statements in fact.
TheEpicTimes.com.
Looking for an IT partner that truly understands your needs? Managed IT Services is the answer. We meet with you regularly to discuss your goals and form a tailored technology plan. Our customers have called us a trusted advisor who delivers. When it comes to IT, we do it all. Firewalls, cloud storage, server migration, and more. Say goodbye to long-term contracts and hello to a team that earns your business month after month. Call 801-706-6980 now and let Managed IT Services transform your IT experience.
Dear Blood River Radio family, precious family, we're going to go right back to Sister Nancy. But I'd like to also like to thank Jason Robb one more time because he sent us a nice donation. We're really proud of him. He is the legal attorney, man over in Zinc, Arkansas. He's out of Harrison, Arkansas. And he's a lawyer for the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan over there. That's the kind of people we hang around with. He sent us a nice donation in, buddy. He's a lawyer, so he's a lawyer after my heart. Anyway, go right back to Sister Nancy. Go ahead, Sister Nancy.
I just wanted to point out something about a comparison with the last days of the Confederacy and the terrible things that happened to Germany. There's a lot of comparisons that can be made. But when General Kemper had recovered somewhat, he wanted to continue his service. And I'm sorry, they had the conscription, and I guess it was 1865, of all 18 to 45 year olds. Kemper was taken, made commander over the reserve, which took in all those men who were under 18 and over 45.
Oh.
Excuse me. And that was a force that was used or could be called up to protect Richmond. So things had gotten pretty bad.
Bad.
I'll leave that to you.
Oh, okay, Nancy, thank you for the information. It's always a history lesson every time Nancy's on. We were talking a little bit earlier about the Confederate Constitution, and a great book, The Confederate Constitution of 1861, An Inquiry into American Constitutionalism, is written by Marshall DeRosa, D-E, capital R-O-S-A, and he is, or was, when the book came out, he was a political science professor at Florida Atlantic University at Boca Raton, Florida. I'm sure if he's still teaching there, they probably got rid of him for saying anything good about the Confederacy. But what you have to understand is what they were trying to do, and that's what he points out in the introduction of this book. The Confederates weren't trying to abandon the original Constitution. They were trying to take back the U.S. Constitution of 1789. The Yankees and the Lincoln administration were trying to change this constitutional agreement. And the Confederates wanted to reaffirm the original Constitution. And they believed very strongly in state sovereignty and the importance of the people. They took the line from the Declaration that government derives its just power from the consent of the government, not the other way around. We don't get the government doesn't lord over us. We're the ones that are supposed to be in charge. The federal dreamers that they had at that time in the North and in the Republican Party determined to establish an authoritarian regime over the South and basically rob the South of everything it had money-wise. So it was a Republican representative government versus Lincoln's tyranny. And he pointed out the hypocrisy in Lincoln's quotation, "Government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth, but not government of Southern people, by Southern people, and for Southern people. They turned an army loose on us to destroy everything they can." The Confederates believe that sovereignty resides with the people, not with the government. And it's going to be interesting to see how this situation in Texas, and, you know, history repeats itself. We all know that. So it's interesting to see how this situation in Texas and the 26 or 23 other states that have sided with Texas. And I've read this morning there are several states that are sending their state militia and a lot of their law enforcement agents to Texas to help them out to protect the border. Because we all know whatever comes across the border in Texas or Arizona or wherever, it's going to wind up in Tennessee or Alabama or New York or Chicago. So it's up to all these other states to help Texas out in this situation.
Yes.
Couple of things about the Confederate Constitution. Drafted in February of 1861, like I said, most of it was very similar to the U.S. Constitution. And it's interesting, in this book, it has the U.S. Constitution, but then in italics, it has where the Confederates added certain things to it. And most of the Confederate's Constitution, excuse me, was really word for word with the U.S. Constitution. Now, one thing they did, just starting from the very first, was the preamble. It said, "We, the people of the Confederate States, each state acting in sovereignty and independent character in order to form a permanent federal government, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility," and so forth and so on. So what they did, and, you know, the U.S. Constitution says, "We, the people," and there's always been an argument about who are we, the people. Is it the individual people, or is it the government that represents the people? Well, the Confederates made sure that the government was established by the states, and it was the states that had the power, and they delegated certain powers, federal powers, to the national government. So they took out that "we the people" can mean anything at all. They said, no, "we the representatives of the sovereign states," and that was the whole point. That they believed, and a lot of people do today as well, that the state government is a buffer between the individuals and the national government. An individual can't stand up to the national government. They've got FBI and CIA and Homeland Security and, you know, all the military on their side. So the state has to stand up for the individuals in that state and stand up to the federal government. And that's basically what Governor Wallace was trying to do in Alabama, and Governor Barnett in Mississippi, and Governor Faubus in Arkansas was trying to have their state stand up to a federal government under Eisenhower and the Kennedys that were taking powers in the federal government that they had no business taking, that education was a state responsibility, not a responsibility of a couple of twits from Hyannisport or a South-hating Army officer. To force that on them, and with the National Supreme Court. So that was one difference in the Confederate Constitution. They defined who we, the people, are. They're the states. Another part of it, they said that the Congress would regulate the taxation and would not be giving money to industry, that you couldn't use the tax money of the government to improve one section of the country to the disadvantage of another section of the country. That was the argument that the South was putting up the money for the United States government. And I've read several accounts of this. In the 1860, the federal budget, and I've read anywhere from $102 million to $105, somewhere in that range. We kind of laugh at that now, but that was big money back then. I mean, now they blow that off just at lunchtime in Washington, $100 million at lunchtime for cold beer and hookers or whatever they spend it on. That's nothing. But that was a lot of money. But the point being that the South was paying about $82 million of that, $102, because of tariffs and taxes on agriculture and imported goods. So the North wanted high tariffs on imported goods to protect their industry. The South was not an industrial nation. It was an agricultural nation. And the cotton was the big selling point for the South to go to the mills in England. And so much of the Southern cotton, it was going to factories in the North, but the majority of it was going to the clothing manufacturing in Great Britain. So that's what the Congress was not going to allow. One section, the Confederate Congress wasn't going to allow it, one section of the country to get rich off of unfair taxation on another section of the country. Another thing that the, in Article 1 about Congress, the Confederate Constitution forbid the importation of slaves into the Confederate States of America from any other country. Now, the Confederate Constitution, unlike the U.S. Constitution, finally took up the issue of slavery. And the U.S. Constitution, just, you know, other than the three-fifths clause in there for representatives, they just kicked the slavery issue down the road and let the next president or the next Congress decide it. Well, they didn't want to do it. Let the next one take care of it. But the Confederate Constitution said you could not import slaves from outside the country into the Confederate States of America. They were trying to cut back on slavery. And that's what all these idiots on CNN and the clowns that are running in the Republican primary, well, some of them have dropped out. But anyway, they can't get that part right. And we'll straighten that out as soon as we get back from the break.
Hang on, folks.
Have you ever had great honey? No, I mean really good, all-natural, raw honey. Well, now you can, thanks to localhoneyman.com. We can ship out our locally made honey all across the U.S. So don't worry, you won't miss out. Plus, Local Honeyman has so many different flavors, like Utah Wildflower, High Desert Delight, Happy Valley, and Blackberry, just to name a few. So purchase your delicious raw honey today at localhoneyman.com.
Hello, friends. This is Jacob from Blood River Radio. We call the kings into account and tell the truth to shame the devil on this show every week because we are of the firm conviction that our cause cannot succeed without true revival amongst the remnant, amongst that principled minority of the dispossessed majority. Now is the time to stand and be counted, to do like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who would not bow down to the false idols of their day, even under pain of death, like the 300 mighty men of valor who surrounded the Midianites with Gideon, or the 7,000 men that God told the prophet Elijah had not bowed their knees to Baal in a time when even calling fire down from heaven would not awaken our kinsmen from their slumber. If you are encouraged by our labors in the trenches for the kingdom and the cause of truth, liberty, and righteousness, I urge you to consider supporting this program. No donation is too small. We can do with thousands or even hundreds what our enemies and the powers and the principalities of this present darkness need tens of millions to do. So please donate today at BloodRiverRadio.com and help us take up the hedge and stand in the gap against the great evils of our time.
Do you treasure your liberty? Well, at LovingLiberty.net, we most certainly do. And we want to help protect your liberty, too. Become part of the family. Everyone knows that the core of any society is the family. Therefore, the government should foster and protect the integrity of its family, we the people. Won't you join us as a Loving Liberty sponsor to help us promote the principles in the 5,000-year leap? Let's restore the miracle that changed the world at LovingLiberty.net.
Excuse me, Captain. I know this may sound silly, but can you fly?
Nope. Never had a lesson.
Dear Blood River Radio audience, we're going right back to the bitter end, but I tell you what, I am so very excited. People, please, if you will, homework for Blood River Radio listeners, audience, I mean, family, look up, see if we can volunteer to go to Texas, to the border, to help those people down there. I, for one, I'm always getting all enthused. I would love to go down there and participate in that. If nothing else, do some live reports from down there. That harkens back to when we had Paul Babu on with TPC years ago. Anyway, back to you, Bitter Ender.
Well, we were talking about the differences in the Confederate Constitution versus the U.S. Constitution, and they didn't want to throw out the U.S. Constitution. They just wanted to correct the errors that were there. And I've always said that, you know, it was a good idea in 1789, but then they saw there were some mistakes that needed to be corrected. And that's what the Confederate Constitution did, and much of it was an exact copy of the U.S. Constitution, word for word, but then they had some important changes. And we were talking about slavery. The Confederate Constitution actually addressed the question of slavery. It said slaves could not be imported into the Confederate States of America from a foreign country. And then it also said, as far as the question of slavery, it was up to the individual states. If a state wanted to abolish slavery, that's fine. The state could do it. If the state wanted to keep slavery, that was up to them. If a new territory wanted to come into the Confederate States as a slave state, fine. If they wanted to abolish slavery in the new territory when they came in, that was fine too. So the whole point of it, that we didn't have a dictatorship out of Washington, we had states that took care of their local business. They set up several different things that were listed in Article 1 that Congress could do. They could set up a post office service. But It had to be self-sufficient. And during the War for Southern Independence, under John Reagan of Texas, who was Postmaster General, in 4 years of war, the Confederate Postal Service operated at a profit. Never had to go back to Congress to ask for a bailout, they never raised postal rates either. Then Article 2 goes into the president of the Confederate States of America. And the way they set this up was they looked at the president and they said, you know, this clown spends his last 2 years in office campaigning for the next 4 years. We're going to fix that. We're going to give the president of the Confederate States of America a six-year term, but you can only be president once. So, Bubba, you better get it right the first time because you're not going to have a second chance. And when they started the government, the president who was elected, Jefferson Davis, was a provisional president of the Confederate States of America for 1 year, and then he had to run for the permanent six-year. So they did that with some of the high government officials and some of the general officers in the military. So you were commissioned a brigadier general as a provisional brigadier general. And then after 1 year, that would be changed to a permanent brigadier general, or you may have been promoted to major general or whatever in that year's time. But what it did was they could look at these people and say, you know, this guy wasn't a good choice for president. And we don't have to impeach him because in two more months he'll be out anyway. He's only provisional. And then Jefferson Davis was, when the permanent government of the Confederacy was put in on February 22nd, George Washington's birthday, 1862, then Jefferson Davis was installed as the first permanent president of the Confederate States with a six-year term. Same thing in the military. You know, this general was a provisional general and, you know, wasn't quite what we'd hoped for. We think he'd probably do a better job running the button factory in Valdosta, Georgia. But thank you for your service, and we think you'd do better somewhere else rather than out on the front lines. So those are a couple of things that were different in the Confederate Constitution. Oh, one other power they gave to the president before I forget. They gave the Confederate president a byline veto. So you get an appropriations bill, and it's got the military budget in there and operation of the country, some really important items. And then unlike what they do now, at midnight they tack on two or three riders for a whole bunch of pork barrel politics additions to the main appropriations budget. And the Confederate president can go through there and zip, knock that out, that out, that out, and it would go back to the person that turned it in. Now, they have to go before the Confederate Congress and get a two-thirds vote to have their pet project put in. So if you wanted to build a memorial outhouse to Senator Jack S. Fogbaum, you're going to have to go back to Congress and explain why the memorial outhouse to Senator Jack S. Fogbaum, like in Little Abner, there's no Jack S. like our Jack S. You have to explain why that's being tacked on to the military budget. So there were a lot of good things in the Confederate Constitution, and we'd probably be a lot better off if we were operating under that today. Oh, one other thing we want to throw in. Under appropriations and Congress was required to have a balanced budget every year. Unless there was a national emergency, like a war, or, you know, four or five hurricanes hit the Gulf Coast at the same time, something like that. So Congress was required by the Confederate Constitution to have a balanced budget. So you couldn't have this runaway spending and printing, you know, tons of money with nothing to back it up. One other thing I'd like to point out, in the book here, Howell Cobb was president of the Congress to get all of this set up. And then it's each of the seven states, it lists the people that signed. And in South Carolina, one of them was C.G. Memminger. And he went on to be Secretary of the Treasury for the Confederate States of America. One of the other signers from South Carolina was William Porcher Miles. Now, he was the one that when the Confederate Congress appointed a flag committee, Mr. Miles turned in the idea of a red flag with a blue diagonal cross which is the Southern Cross, the Celtic Cross, or the Cross of St. Andrew, to the Flag Committee. And they didn't take that one. At that time, we only had seven states. So it was really hard to balance seven stars on four arms of the flag. And the other thing that torpedoed this idea, when they had cut it down to the Final Four or the Sweet 16 or however many they had, they had the flags hanging up horizontally in the Senate chamber in the Capitol building at Montgomery, which was at that time the capital of the Confederacy. That's before Virginia seceded and it was moved up to Richmond. So they were hanging up horizontally, and one of the senators said, "Well, I ain't voting for no flag. It looks like a pair of suspenders hanging up there." So that one got the axe, and then the First National flag is the one they came up with, which had the blue Canton in the corner and then the red, white, red stripes, which was known as the Stars and Bars. And the red flag with the blue diagonal cross was used by the military after the first battle at Manassas, because that First National flag, when it was hanging limp on the flagpole or was smoke and dust on the battlefield, you had that blue up in the corner and then red and white. And off at a distance, that looked too much like the U.S. flag. So by then, we had six more states that voted to leave the Union. So you had 13 states. You would have four arms of the flag with three stars on each arm of the flag, of the diagonal cross, and one in the middle. So you had 13 stars, and that balanced out on the flag. So the what we call the battle flag today, or 99% of the people call the Confederate flag, never was an official government flag. It was the military flag. And that flag out on the battlefield didn't look anything at all like the U.S. flag. So there was no problem with that being confused with the U.S. flag. Now, they did incorporate that in 1863. They changed the flag. Congress changed the flag. They took the blue Canton out of the corner of the flag and replaced that with the battle flag. And then they thought there was too much red on the flag, so they took out the two red stripes. And so now you had the square Confederate battle flag up in the corner, and the rest of the flag was white. And that was the second national flag of the Confederacy. Oh. The first time it was used officially, unfortunately, it covered the casket of Stonewall Jackson, Thomas Jackson, after he died from his wounds at Chancellorsville and was brought back to be buried in Lexington. That flag covered the casket on the caisson that they were bringing Jackson back to Lexington. The problem with that was when it was hanging limp on the flagpole, it had too much white on it. It looked like a flag of truce or a flag of surrender. So, well, they were practical. You know, things looked like they would work, and they didn't work out, so they changed it for a practical reason. So in March of 1865, they added a red stripe at the end of the second national flag to distinguish it from a flag of truce or a flag of surrender. Very few of those were made. The war was pretty much over by then. And I have a friend of mine down in Georgia, Hank Guggenheim. I would mistakenly call that the third national flag, and he would always get on me and go, "Andrews, you're such a pathetic little junior high school girl cheerleader. That's not the third national flag. That's the current national flag of the Confederacy." So I stand corrected. Hank would always get me straightened out there. One other person, well, that pretty much covers it up, those that signed off on the Constitution. And I hope our listeners got some information about our government, how it was founded, and how it was set up. Thank you very much, Eddie, for your time. And many thanks to Nancy for the great information she always brings to the program.
Well, we didn't get finished tonight. We'll take it up next week. Thank you so much, Gene. Thank you, Nancy. Thank you, Miss Monica. Thank you, Rand. Thank you, Sister Lizzie. And thank you, Blood River Radio family. People, same time next week. It'll be a new month. It'll be February 3rd. It looks like. So God bless you, and good night, everybody. Good night, y'all.